You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Alan Weisman's last book, The World Without Us, was an elegant thought experiment. What would happen if people vanished from our planet? Now in his new book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth, he ponders what it would take to add humans back into the picture. As part of his research, he traveled to 20 different countries, interviewed scores of experts in pursuit of the question, how many people can Earth support without capsizing? What kind of a shift in consciousness is necessary so that the question people ask themselves is not, is it good for the Americans? Is it good for the Russians? Is it good for the Irish? But is it good for the planet? How do we challenge a fundamentalist outlook that God has preordained our doom? Does the answer lie in limiting consumption or limiting childbirth? And who makes those decisions? Alan Weisman's The World Without Us was an international bestseller, translated into 34 languages. He's the recipient of many awards for his reporting from around the world. His previous books include An Echo in My Blood, Gaviotas, A Village to Reinvent the World, and La Frontera, The United States Border with Mexico. An award-winning journalist, his reports have appeared in many major magazines, including Harper's, The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic Monthly, and on NPR. He's a senior radio producer for Homeland Productions, and we're very happy to have him here tonight. Ursula K. Heise is a professor in the Department of English and at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. She's thought long and deeply and hard about many of these same questions that Alan has pondered in his book. She's the past president of the Association for the Study of Literature and the Environment. Her books include Chronoschisms, Time, Narrative, and Postmodernism, Sense of Place and Sense of Planet, The Environmental Imagination of the Global, and After Nature, Species Extinction and Modern Culture. And she's currently finishing a book called Where the Wild Things Used to Be, which I think is a great title, Narrative Database and Endangered Species. Please welcome our two guests tonight, Alan Weisman and Ursula Heise. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. It's a great pleasure to be here tonight with Alan Weisman, who's one of the most imaginative, most interesting writers on big environmental issues. And as Louise Steinman already mentioned, his last book that appeared 6 years ago was called The World Without Us. And I'm somebody who really likes science fiction and teaches a lot of science fiction. And so one thing I loved about this book, even though it is a book that tries to think about how our environmental impact would reverse itself or endure if all humans were gone, one thing I liked about that was the science fiction conceit. That's something that science fiction novelists do, sort of imagine a world where there is few or no humans left. So, Alan, are you a secret science fiction fan? Do you read a lot of science fiction?
I'm an open and declared science fiction fan. I read it all the time when I was growing up.
Well, that would explain it.
Well, you know, great science fiction writers, Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov are two of the ones that were a huge influence on me. Basically took important scientific concepts and couched them in a story with characters and narrative and dialogue and drama and tension. And so readers just get sucked into it. And at the end of the book, you learn an awful lot about something important. Right. And one of our great writers today, Gregory Benford, was a physicist. I find that his novels are just fascinating, and I know about physics by the time I'm done with them, which is not an easy thing to teach me physics. So,
science fiction sort of has become the novel of ideas in some way. Now, this book is not science fiction. It's very much about the present world. Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth, ? Now, you had sort of talked about the problem of population at the end of The World Without Us. What do you see as, and yet the contrast is striking. I mean, that book was about a world without people. This is as this planetary cycle shows, here's a few people and a lot of trees and greenery, and here's it's a black part of the Earth with just a lot of people. So it's in some sense the opposite vision. It's too many people or a lot of people. So what is the connection between these two books? How did you get from The World Without Us to Countdown?
Well, you know, for those of you who didn't read The World Without Us, it really is kind of a red herring because it's really about my desire to have a world with us. But having covered so many environmental stories all over the world, and a lot of them for the Los Angeles Times Magazine right here, who sent me to Antarctica's ozone hole and to some rainforests that were going down here and there, and you know, it was at Chernobyl for Harper's Magazine, and then my Homelands group, you know, we've done NPR series on a lot of environmental destruction. I started to see, you know, all this stuff is really not just discrete events, but they're all connected. And I wanted to find a way to put them together into one book. But the problem with environmental books is that oftentimes they're only read by people who already understand this stuff,
right?
Because everybody else finds it so depressing or so scary. You know, like, who wants to pick up a book that says, oh my God, you know, if we don't stop what we're doing, we may all die, you know? So, in The World Without Us, I kind of played some jujitsu with that.
Right.
I just figured, you know, if that's what everybody's worried about, you know, why not just kill them off in the beginning, and then that's not a problem, but you get to hang around to see.
And then
what,
we can breathe, right?
Yeah, you get to hang around to see what happens next. But the, quote, science fiction-y part of that book, it's really only one paragraph long, I suggest, because I actually had to make sure that it wasn't science fiction in the reader's mind, because lots of people are turned off by science fiction. So I had to do something that was plausible enough that it could happen. You know, say a Homo sapiens specific virus pick us all off. Or, you know, like AIDS, if instead of being passed by fluids, if it suddenly went mutated and went airborne. Mm-hmm. Or, and then really there weren't a lot of options. You know, like, you know, suppose that Jesus comes back and raptures us all away, or space aliens. And this was, you know, just within the realm of possibility enough that it wasn't right. science fiction, but it was remote enough that readers really weren't too concerned mm-hmm. that this was going to happen tomorrow. And then I was able to proceed on. But the whole idea for that was wipe us off the map, show how, as I learned in my research, that nature is incredibly resilient and it can refill empty niches that we have unfortunately extinguished their residence and would flourish rather beautifully and wipe out even our traces and our infrastructure in less time than we would imagine. And I wanted readers to think, wow, that's so beautiful. Isn't there some way that we could have that healthy, restored world, but us still be part of it, you know, only in some harmonious balance with it rather than, you know, overwhelming it like we're doing? So at the end of The World Without Us, I ended up doing something that I didn't expect. I had this interview with a guy, some of you have read the book, remember this. He was the founder of something called the Voluntary Human Extinction Movement. And
not a science fiction
book. Yeah, and last night I was speaking at Powell's Bookstore in Portland, Oregon, and he came to see me.
He's still alive?
He is still alive, but that's the whole point. You know, his belief is that, well, you know, humanity's been a good idea for a while, but now it's clearly not working so well because we're overwhelming the place, and eventually we're just going to, you know, push something off the planet that we wish we would have held on to, but then we'll find out too late that, oops, we needed that one. So it says, instead of just dragging everything down with us, why don't we just admit that it's clearly not working anymore and stop procreating? And he said to me, think of it, he says, you know, every 10 years, every decade, as there were fewer and fewer people, the world would turn wilder and more beautiful until the very end, the last people would see the Garden of Eden restored, and then, you know, we hand it over to some other species. And in the moment that he said that, it really clarified for me why I had written that book, was because I wanted a world with us. So I started thinking, is there some compromise between what we're doing right now and what he's suggesting? So what we're doing right now, obviously, I had to figure out, well, if how are we procreating? And the first thing you do is you find out these numbers, and they're huge numbers. You can't wrap your head around them. You know, like 120 million babies are born every year, and 40 million people die, so that means that we're adding 80 million. Well, I just did some long division by 365. Thank God there's calculators. And and what I discovered was something that me and other readers really could get, that every 4 days we were adding, every 4 to 4.5 days, a million more people to the planet. This clearly was not a sustainable number. So at the end of The World Without Us, I brought that up. And I left hanging the question, should we do something about this? Is it time for population to be back on the table of the possible solutions, if there are any, to how we can have a sustainable future and strike a truce with the rest of nature?
So that we should probably show, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it just became such a talking point. You know, that book is out in 34 languages, and I went to lots of countries and lots of cultures, and everybody wanted to talk about that. Mm-hmm. So finally, I decided, well, it's such a loaded topic. You know, religion and economics and all sorts of things intervene when we're talking about population. And also, it makes us very uncomfortable on a very, very gut level. Because, like any other organism, we're designed to make copies of ourselves. In fact, to make extra copies of ourselves, because until medical technology, unfortunately, a lot of those copies would die, and so we'd produce enough so we could be assured that somebody would survive and we'd keep going. The idea of having to limit that, literally limit doing what comes naturally, is kind of unnatural. So it's loaded. But I decided that as a journalist, I should try to look at this and try to see, can we figure out how many humans would be the right number for this planet? And if so, is there something we can do about it?
Yeah, I think there's also other reasons why this is an uncomfortable topic and a difficult one to write about. There's a whole history of writing about overpopulation, which goes back to 1798 and Malthus's essay on the principle of population. And then in the 1960s, there was a book that you mentioned in yours, Paul and Ann Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, which is really one of the catalysts for the modern environmentalist movement, that was a very apocalyptic book and predicted dire things to come, large-scale famines, mm-hmm. if population growth rates weren't brought under control. And then it was a topic that for a while went away. And when it came back in the late 80s and early 90s, I'm still struck by the way in which the language really changed that we used to talk about these issues. People didn't really talk about overpopulation so much anymore because people weren't so sure that we knew what the right population was and when it was over. People started talking about reproductive rights, women's health, women's education. So it was a whole different kind of discourse. But still, it sort of remained a dicey issue, and environmental movements have run into conflict when they've brought up these issues. And I think one of the things that comes up whenever somebody writes a book about population growth and the environmental problems it causes is, okay, why are you white, affluent world environmentalists talking about population growth, and aren't you really shifting the blame from your own overconsumption to the poor people of the world? And then often that gets a little more pointed, and they say, well, why is it, you know, white guys over 50 that tell brown women under 30 what they can and can't do with their bodies? How is your book different, or how did you deal with that loadedness when you wrote the book?
Well, these are all really important and fair questions. And first of all, I read everything that I possibly could. And you're right, you know, it runs the gamut. In fact, some of you are noticing this is a pretty thick book. about the last 100 pages of it are a bibliography and index, and it's pretty small type. And first of all, I found, you know, a lot of what's been written about population has been written by demographers who are kind of like accountants with, the joke is they're accountants without a sense of humor. Because, you know, they're not just dealing with mere dollars or shekels, they're talking about us. But unfortunately, so much of that has been written about population is statistical, and it takes something really important and it gets kind of dry, and people just don't find it very entertaining. So first of all, I had to figure out a way how to insert a narrative in here, how to put a really, you know, scenes, really interesting people on this thing. But also how to walk through that minefield of all these loaded special interests. You know, everybody thinks automatically, you know, well, Catholics and Mormons have a real special interest in here. And frankly, every religion does, because every religion starts out with its mandate to be fruitful and multiply. And the extremists, you know, who still interpret their religion with the most literal sense, as it was cast in the very beginning, tend to keep doing that. But I had to come to grips with this, you know, particularly this issue that you raise right now, of the fear that any attempt to manage population, or even worse, I mean, the word that they use, you know, is control population, is yet one more way for males to subjugate women and, first of all, heap the blame for the environmental problems that we have right now on women, and then make them submit to some sort of humiliation, like forced sterilization or forced abortions or whatever it may be, or chemical injections. I talked to an awful lot of women about this,
right.
And there are some who are still very concerned about this, and because I go into the history of when that kind of stuff happened. I mean, the eugenics movement in the United States, when we think about eugenics, it sounds so quaint, particularly, you know, the idea that only the right people should procreate, and people who are are mentally disabled or physically disabled from birth should not, and they should be sterilized even, or sometimes the wrong color. This was taught in all of our universities here and in Europe. I mean, this was considered to be accepted science until Hitler, you know, kind of took it to the extreme that suddenly people realized, you know, what the truth of that was. But those are deep scars. And to understand that there's a way to abuse anything, including the idea that, you know, well, at a certain point, are there too many of us? And is there something that we can do about it? It's a really important question, but we also, I hope, know now, and this is something that I take great pains to show in this book, that the only way to implement it is through absolute just application. It turns out, this is kind of skipping ahead here, but the best contraception of all on this planet is educating females. And not only when you educate a female, well, a couple of simple things happen. They tend to defer their childbearing until their education is over. So that means they're not starting to pop out babies when they're 12 or 13. And then once they have that education, they have something interesting and useful and economically helpful to their families. Most females do want to be mothers, but you cannot exercise your profession if you've got 7 kids hanging on your aprons. So they, on the average, throughout the world, educated women tend to have 2 children or fewer now. This not only helps deal with a population problem, but it helps empower women. And if we're looking for social justice on this planet, there's no better way than empowering women.
So, I agree, but I mean, there is another twist to that, though, which is that it still leaves the burden on the women to save the world.
And well, I do talk in here about some of the new male contraceptives that are now coming online.
But you spend like 2 or 3 pages on that.
Well, they're not that many, yet.
Right? but that's an interesting question, right? That the burden still remains on the women to take care of the contraception. There isn't the idea that maybe it's the men that need a re-education, and maybe we need to think about how men might change their minds about how desirable it is to have big families.
It's a wonderful idea, but, you know, and we can also say, well, if everybody stops consuming as much, then we wouldn't have so many problems on this planet. But changing people's mindsets is going to take a long time. I wish that weren't the case. Educating every male to be totally respective of what females need, it would be wonderful if it happened first and then females were then free to do what they want. But I think it's going to happen the other way around. Females will get empowered and then men will learn that they have to respect them.
So what about this problem of consumption, though? That comes up a lot, that we tell the developing world, you know, have fewer kids, and they say, well, look at what your one kid consumes, which is what 200 of our kids consume, and, you know, you turn off your air conditioning, and then we'll think about reducing birth rates. I mean, why are you so invested in thinking that bringing down the population is the problem, when it seems that that would be a harder and more innate impulse to work against than to say maybe we can do with a fraction of the consumption that we're currently engaging in?
Well,
as we historically have. I mean, the amount that the West is consuming is historically unprecedented.
Look, I think it's a great idea for us to do with less, but I also know that there's no condom for consumption. People, you know.
Well, you don't need a condom to reduce consumption.
Come on. You and I are conversing right now through these microphones. They're electrical. We all got here through some conveyance today. We're hooked on energy. We're addicted to the stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, even if we did our best to try to reduce our footprint as far as we can, we're still exhaling carbon dioxide into the atmosphere now just through the minimal daily life that we can come up with. And that's not just us. This is even the poor of the world. And I go to some of the poorest countries in the world here. And they still need food. And food, I mean, to give a sense of how many of us are on this planet right now, 40% of the world, terrestrial world, is devoted to feeding ourselves. Either we're cultivating or we're grazing on this land. Mm-hmm. And that's a big chunk of this planet, and there's a whole lot of other species that ought to be here. I would love to bring down consumption, but I just simply don't see us being able to do that on a big enough scale, since even those of us who are conscious of the problem are still contributing to it.
So let me ask you two follow-up questions there, and then we're going to move on to something else. But one is the so you believe that it's that controlling people's impulse to reproduce is easier to do than controlling their impulse to consume. And why isn't that sort of circumventing the question of, on one hand, radical inequality? I mean, you're totally right. Everybody obviously needs some basic footprint to nourish themselves and have housing, have heating, and so forth. But it's also true that, you know, the old scary figure that, you know, U.S. Americans are 5% of the world population, but we use up 20% of the resources. So that there's obviously some disproportion there that's also worth addressing. And that may have something to do with the economic system that we're in. Well, so wouldn't that be important to address
Sure, address it. Let's all try to consume less, because we are the most overpopulated country on Earth if you multiply our consumption by our numbers. I'm all for it. But I don't want to control anybody. I went to all these different countries and talk to all these different cultures and religious systems to find out, is there something in their belief system or in their histories or their liturgies that might accommodate the idea of, in times of need, so to speak, refraining from embracing so much, as Ecclesiastes suggests that sometimes we have to do. When people think about population, quote, control, they immediately think of the Chinese one-child policy. And they think, I don't want to do that. I don't want anybody coming in my bedroom and telling me what to do. And I don't want it either. And frankly, most Chinese don't either. I spent a month in China for this book. But it turns out that there are many different ways of bringing population down to a much more reasonable, healthy, and sustainable level that don't involve any draconian or coercive implementations when it doesn't involve anybody telling you what you should do. What it does is give you the incentives to do something. First of all, it gives you access to contraception. And second, let me give you an example. One of the places, it was the last trip I took for this book, was to Iran. And here we think about Iran as being a charter member of the evil empire, because this is the propaganda that goes out. As actually, you know, Persia is this fabulous society that's existed a lot longer than we have. But it happened that when the Islamic Revolution took place, 1979, they had barely had a chance to start organizing themselves when, because they were still so disorganized, Saddam Hussein attacked them because they had this oil-rich province right on the border, and he figured this is a good time to go in and seize it. Saddam Hussein also had the backing of NATO, and they provided him with a lot of weaponry, and unfortunately they also provided him with the feedstock for nerve gas, which he had already used on his Kurdish minority, and he started using against the Iranians, who all they had were bodies. The Ayatollah Khomeini issued a plea to every fertile female in Iran to get pregnant and to produce a 20 million man army to help stave off the invaders. And they held them to a truce, or to a stalemate, for 8 years. And finally, after the truce was declared, some people in planning and budget in Iran realized they had a big problem because they had this population bubble now that within 10 years they were going to have to employ all these people, and their economic system was nowhere near prepared to do that. And they went and they talked to the supreme leader and they warned him. They said, you know, a population filled with under or unemployed young men who get very frustrated and very angry is a very unstable place, and we have to do something. I mean, basically they're describing what Pakistan is today, which is another country that I went to. So the Iranians ended up implementing what became possibly, according to the United Nations, one of the most humane and best family planning programs in history. What they did, first of all, was propaganda. They put up these banners saying, you know, one is enough, two is good. But they didn't tell anybody how many children they should have, because the Chinese one-child policy had been going on for 10 years already, and that wouldn't fly in Persia. They told people that have as many children as you want. The only thing that was compulsory was premarital classes. Everybody who was getting married had to go to class, either in a mosque or in a health center, to talk about, to learn what to expect in marriage, which is not such a bad idea. And the Quakers do it here, actually, in the United States. Among other things they learned in those classes was how much does it cost to raise, feed, clothe, and educate a child? They got that message. They made all family planning from condoms up to tubal ligations and vasectomies available. They even issued a fatwa saying that there was nothing in the Quran that said if wisdom dictates you have the number of children you can responsibly care for, that you can partake of those things. And they made it all available. I talked to this very devout Muslim OBGYN, a woman in Tehran, who talked about these horseback brigades that they went on, and to the remotest villages.
That's a great part of the book.
Bringing these things. Yeah, it's really lovely. But the other thing they did that was so vital was that they encouraged women to stay in school for the reasons that I've already told you. So today, 60% of university students in Iran are female, and they brought their population growth rate down to replacement, meaning two parents have two children, essentially replacing themselves, a year faster than China's one-child policy. So, you know, this can be done. And I have another chapter in the book in Thailand that did something totally, totally different. And they also came below replacement rate.
Well, let's walk. I mean, one of the things that is amazing about the book is how much you've traveled around the world and how many frequent flyer miles you must have racked up in the process. You really visited a lot of countries and a lot of very, very different countries. So let's maybe talk about some of these different case scenarios. So at the beginning, you have a few chapters that deal with the places where the process that you've just described for Iran really hasn't started or hasn't worked. So let's, for example, talk very interestingly about Niger and about the Middle East. Do you want to just give us a very brief synopsis of what is it that in those countries hasn't worked? Why hasn't something like what's taken place in Iran not been able to happen in those two regions?
Well, Niger is a Sahel country. It's in French West Africa. And it's one of the poorest countries on Earth. And it also has the highest birth rate on Earth right now. Women average nearly 8 children per. And they are so poor that they literally keep popping out babies to stay ahead of the Grim Reaper because so many children die on them. It's mostly desert. Well, you know what the Sahel is. It's sort of this transition between the Sahara Desert and the savannas of Africa. And as the Nigerians told me, that they're now in a situation where, you know, the 10-year drought cycle that they used to be able to count on, you know, to grow, you know, millet as their staple, you know, then it became a 5-year drought cycle, and then it's a 3-year drought cycle, and the 3-year drought cycle actually hadn't ended.
And what was that caused by?
Well, probably climate change. I mean, it's always been being on the edge of the Sahara, sort of a place where you're living on the edge, and you have to make do with sort of a meager, you know, a meager amount of rainfall. But they were just on the right edge of it for a long time, only that edge is now creeping down on them.
So under those conditions, why wouldn't they reduce the number of children? What are the social factors?
Well, I guess, you know, it's a cultural pattern. And both men and women explained it to me there. The men, they are still traditional polygamists. In the Quran, polygamy was allowed up to 4 wives, and many men, you know, continue to have them. You know, it's funny. At one point, I was speaking to an imam in Niger, and he talked about, you know, it says in the Quran that we can have 4 women, so that's what, you know, Allah wants us to have.
Yeah.
And it says that children are a gift from God, so we cannot refuse gifts from God. And it says that, you know, God will take care of everyone. And I said, well, look, you know, every village I've been to, 150 to 200 kids died last year. Who's taking care of them? You know, and he says, well, that's because, you know, sinners get punished. I said, kids are not sinners. And he says, their parents were sinners. So, you know, this is a very fundamentalist argument. An hour later, I'm with another imam who's opening the Quran, and he's showing me in the Quran where Muhammad says that every child is entitled to 2 years of a mother's milk. And he says, this is birth spacing. This is what we must be doing. And there's nothing in the Quran, just like the fatwa that was issued in Iran said, that says that you can't use whatever means you have to be responsible parents for the ones that you can afford to take care of. These two imams were brothers. And this is religion anywhere. You know, anybody can interpret the holy books to whatever way they want. And what is unfortunately happening now in Niger, and I talked to many tribal leaders there, that they're seeing everything change on them. Every village I went to, they said, you know, if you would have been here 25 years ago, that house that's over there, and they pointed to this place about a meter away, 100 meters away. They said, you couldn't have even seen it for all the trees. I said, what happened to all the trees? They said, well, you know, we used to harvest them for firewood, but then suddenly we were harvesting them faster than they would grow back because there were more of them. And then also it got drier and they weren't growing back. And just these terribly sad stories.
So in a case like this, is the problem religion, which has also seemed to be a little bit what you were suggesting in the chapters on the Middle East, or is the problem patriarchy? Is it the social structure that sort of systematically doesn't let women have a say.
Well, I asked women, I got to sit with two chieftains' wives. One of them he'd been married to since she was 12, she was now 20, and the other one was 25, and she was, he told me that he'd had 17 wives over the years, and, right. And I asked these women, what would you think about using family planning? And it basically scared them because they said, but what if our children die? Because children die on them all the time. And we're using this family planning, and then we won't get pregnant enough, and then my husband will just go with some other woman. And right. So, yeah, in that sense, it's a patriarchal system. But, patriarchal systems are something that have occurred all over the world, and we have gotten better and better mm-hmm. at leveling out the balance of equality between the genders. We're not all the way there by any means.
No, indeed not.
No. I mean,
in this country.
We have to do better, but I think that what my research in this book eventually brings us to is that this is one of those situations where we could kill a lot of birds with one stone. We could help bring ourselves back to a more reasonable relationship with the rest of the planet using technology that we already have. I mean, this doesn't involve any huge leaps to come up with some fancy new kind of energy that still wouldn't solve the fact that we're using so much of the planet to feed ourselves. This is something that we already know how to do. And if we did it equitably, it would free up women. I mean, many women that I talk to in many countries who had finally the opportunity to use contraception. Well, let's look at how it was implemented in Mexico. Mexico had the highest birth rate on the planet back in the 70s. The population, the immigration pressure that we feel, that we experience here now is largely because Mexico did not have the carrying capacity. It's only got about 20% arable land. They couldn't feed everybody. They couldn't employ everybody. So people start coming up here. Through U.S. pressure back then, Mexico implemented a family planning program. And I was living in Mexico back then. It was brilliant because they would go into these little remote villages and these guys would come with muleback carrying these polystyrene saddlebags. And polystyrene because you don't need that, to preserve temperature for birth control pills. But you do for what else they were offering, which is polio vaccine, DPT vaccine. And women would come to the clinics if they knew that they could bring their living children and get them vaccinated so they knew that they probably wouldn't die on them. And then they really accepted them. That was prong one of their program. The other one was really delightful. Soap operas, the telenovela. There was a visionary director named Miguel Sabido wrote all these soap operas. And for about 10 years, you'd watch them on television, and there would be the subtle message of, the family with only a couple kids is doing a lot better than the family with way too many kids. And then there would be some of the tension things, the wife says, "Oh, I'm so tired, I don't want to have another child." And the macho husband is saying, "But you have, and then gradually, a series of episodes, he finally comes around, or maybe he doesn't, and she goes off with someone else. But you can track the how fertility came down in Mexico during the whole time that those shows were airing. And now that there's a woman who's now living in this town named Katie Elmore, who I interviewed for this book, who's now producing this series called Isla, which is geared towards high school kids here in Los Angeles. And it's got great drama, and the subtle message is you really don't want to get pregnant as a teenager. That's going to screw a lot of things up. So there are all these novel ways of doing it that ultimately are liberating for women. And I've met some terrific women in the population, health, and environment movement who really believe that this is not only the best thing that we can do for public health and for helping to save the environment, it's the best thing for women too.
So let's move on, in the interest of covering at least some of the highlights of your book, let's move on to some of the countries where there has been success in population control or the population is stagnating. So let's take the example that you already mentioned of China and that of Japan. So in China, I mean, you talked about the way in which to most Westerners the idea that people would be forcibly limited to one child is repugnant. But we all recognize, and you do in your book, that without that, there would have been 400 million more Chinese.
400 million more Chinese.
So that in a certain sense, it was successful, yet one would have to say that in spite of that, China is now one of the countries that that's causing some of the biggest environmental problems. So the question would be, even though that is to some extent a success, doesn't it come back to industrialization? And then what about Japan? Japan is another country where the population is going down, but not a happy country economically, right? Not environmentally either, though probably for reasons that have nothing to do with
population. Well, that's a matter of perspective. I mean, most people on Earth, if you think that most people on Earth are very poor, would kill to live in a place like Japan, frankly. But let's go to China first.
Yeah, I meant it economically. You're absolutely right. Japanese have a great standard of living.
You know, before we completely dismiss the Chinese as being brutal for what they did, we have to remember why they did it. They suffered one of those famines that Malthus was talking about. It was the biggest famine in the history of the planet. Nearly, you know, 40 to the high end calculations, 44 million people died in a planet. In a famine. Now, granted, there was mismanagement during the Cultural Revolution was greatly responsible for that, but they really had outstripped their ability to produce food for everybody, and as a result, you know, they felt that they had to do something. We learned
a
lot from the
Chinese. What is really wrong with a forcible population policy like that? Well, I mean, couldn't you argue that we're maybe too private about this, that we think this is just our private decision, and we don't think about the public consequences of it. So why is it so repugnant to think that there should be some kind of official public?
You know, I remember when I was on book tour for The World Without Us in China, and I met a lot of young women, and most of them didn't have many problems with the one-child policy at all, partly because they're environmentally conscious, and, you know, they knew that. I mean, right now, China, I actually go around the country in this book with scientists from the National Academy of Sciences in China who are right now involved in the biggest environmental mitigation program in the history of the world, and the most expensive one, $40 billion to put the trees back that all those Chinese farmers cut down. That is now, you know, causing erosion and drought and flooding and all this stuff. The young women tend to feel that, you know, most of them now are living in cities. China's urbanizing fast, and you don't have room for
it's
more than one child,
right?
And it's expensive, sure. And they're all educated now, and they want to do something with their livelihoods. But another thing that the Chinese experiment was helpful for, though in a very sobering way, was that we learned some of the pitfalls, particularly of coercive, you know, forced implementation of family planning. And that is that, let's face it, everywhere politicians can be very abusive people. And in China, some of the bureaucrats have done things like, you know, because they had quotas to meet, you know, so forcible sterilizations, forcible abortions. I talked to many Chinese women who, you know, they got pregnant a second time by mistake. No problem when you just admit it. You get, instead of maternity leave, you get abortion leave. The factory pays for it. They take care of your medical care. It's a complicated thing in a society that is different from ours.
And there's also a huge gender disparity now in terms of sheer numbers because of this.
And right? This is one of the things that we have learned is really difficult for cultural reasons. Now, in China, the gender disparity was not so much cultural as it was rural. On the farm, you need a lot of kids, and if they're males, they're stronger farmhands, is what was believed. Now that they're living in cities, actually girl babies are starting to become more favored because, you know, a single girl who's got two parents and maybe four living grandparents, she turns out to be a much more nurturing, caring child to those elderly people. And it's funny, the tables are starting to turn now in the cities. But I have a worse example in the book in the state of Haryana in India, where it's really cultural. It's unfortunately an uninformed religious opinion that in Hindu religion that the only way to go to heaven is to have a son to light your funeral pyre. So there are, you know, these clandestine ultrasound machines that circulate around the state. You know, these corrupt lab technicians or doctors, and in some villages there's like 1,000 boys per 661 females. And some of you have heard some of these reports about these horrendous rapes in India. Well, it's kind of logical when there's so many more men than there are female, you know, that sometimes men just go crazy, and this is what happens. So this is a real warning to us. But also, education can help really, you know, control this kind of excessive behavior. Because I went to many holy men in India, swamis, pujaris, the head of the biggest temple in Mumbai, who is in this book, says to me, you know, that's just an old myth. He says, I've got two daughters, and they can light a match just as easily as any boy can, you know. So, you know, we hope to educate people more and more. And, you know, we've got better methods of spreading the words now, social media, all these kinds of things.
So let's talk about Japan, because I think it's an interesting and a crucial country in your book, because in some ways it is a society that has achieved the goal of actually being below replacement. But that causes all kinds of economic problems, since the economic system is predicated on growth. So tell us a little bit about what the problems are and what do you see as the solution for that? I mean, right now, most economies around the world are in one way or another dependent on growth. Well, so how do we deal with that once, if we were to achieve a declining population? How is Japan dealing with
that? Well, again, it depends on who you're talking to as to what is really a problem. But first, let's explain why Japan has got a shrinking population right now. Japan, some of you remember that they started World War II because they had an overpopulation problem. They needed to expand, they thought, and so they invaded Manchuria to help relieve the population pressure on the island. And then, of course, they got greedy and they kept going, and eventually...
But you don't think that was sort of more an ideological justification? Because, I mean, Germany, you know, had this...
Wait a minute, Germany...
...idea. They wanted more life space, right?
Lincoln's yes,
wrong,
exactly.
But it was not.
Yeah, and that's why they invaded Poland. I mean,
but that was an ideological justification for military expansion. It wasn't really that it was caused by overpopulation.
Well, in Japan's case, it was. It's an island nation, and they couldn't produce enough food. They were already buying from Manchuria, and at a certain point they said, why don't we just make it that way? But they did have plans to move people over there, and that's why they kept going and invading all of China. So they lost the war, and then their soldiers came back, just as our soldiers came back and took up with their wives for the same reason. But Japan's economy was totally wrecked, and they were starving. Within 4 years, their baby boom commenced, and their population added another 10 million on top of their pre-war population. And then everybody was starving, and Japan had to take emergency measures. This is before birth control pills. They legalized abortion. So, and many millions of Japanese women partook of this because they didn't want to watch another baby die of hunger. So they cut off that baby boom. And so now today, as that last overgrown Japanese generation dies off, there's a much smaller generation to replace them, and their population has actually started coming down now, and because they've had fewer children, and also their fertility rate has dropped because educated women, again, they don't want to have a lot of kids, crowded conditions, you can't have an apartment in Tokyo with 7 kids in it. So the population is now moving towards just past the middle of the century, they're going to be back to their World War II population. And a lot of economists are really freaked out about this because there's this mantra that we don't even question sometimes, that economic growth is the the measure of economic health. But how do you keep growing on a planet that doesn't keep growing? I mean, we all remember the housing debacle a couple years ago over which the world has not really recovered sufficiently. And that's because at a certain point, you know, to keep the wealth expanding and expanding, you know, the way we do it is we loan money into existence. And we ran out of viable mortgage holders, people who could really afford a mortgage. So we invented these fuzzy mortgages that said, you don't have to pay very much down at all right now, but in 7 or 10 years, you're going to have enough money and you're going to not only be able to pay the mortgage, but a balloon payment on that. Well, guess how well that worked? You know, it was based on fantasy. And I speak to many economists in this book who believe that it is a fantasy on a finite planet to suggest that we can keep growing. And one of them, his name is Akihiko Matsutani, is a Japanese economist from a very distinguished institute there. He's no radical. But he sees that what's going on right now in Japan is opportunity to get real and to get realistic and to get away from this growth kind of economy that has made people crowd into these port cities and heavy industries. And now there's this chance because the hinterlands are emptying out. A lot of those old farmers are dying off. Young people are starting to discover that, well, you know, there's cheaper land out there. There's cheaper housing out there. They're starting to move. And he says, as our population inevitably gets smaller, wages aren't going to drop, because laborers are going to become more valuable. But demand will drop, so working hours may drop. And that means people are going to have more leisure time, and that's one of the ways that we will redefine prosperity. Now, this whole thing about...
But would that then mean deindustrializing? Because surely, I mean, a company that couldn't promise its stockholders that there was going to be more profit the following quarter would lose its capital backing pretty soon and would probably... eventually have to close down.
Well,
so how does somebody like Matsutani deal with it, with those kinds of issues, that we're still in a system that doesn't really allow for people just to go back to the country without any consequences for the economy as a whole?
Well, he suggests that investing in the future will be more of like a bond market, perpetual bonds, he calls them, you know, than a stock market where you're going through these huge gyrations and you're hoping to strike it rich, but that's always still putting us into precarious territory, and ever more so all the time. But it's going to be a more steady state thing, that you'll be guaranteed a, maybe not one of these astronomical, you know, killings in the market, but you'll be guaranteed something that is much more stable and much more dependable when you know that your economy is existing within the bounds of reality.
But so how does that fit together with what you said earlier, that you don't think that you can actually very well control people's desire to acquire more stuff? And you yourself talk about the quite legitimate desire of a lot of populations around the world to get not even to an U.S.-American standard of living, but to get to a Japanese or American standard of living. So how can you accomplish that? How can you satisfy that desire to reach that standard of living? And how do you live with the assumption that you can't control people's desire to acquire more and yet say we're not going to have an economy that will expand?
Well, you know, Ursula, I don't know for sure because I didn't write a book about consumption. There's a whole lot of people writing them. I wrote one about population. But I did ask those kinds of questions of all these
right.
economists, and they really feel that we can be trading a much more sensible lifestyle for, you know, or the quality of life, and not just the quantity of stuff becomes right. very appealing. In fact, one of the best institutes for ecological environment that we have in the United States is the Gund Institute at the University of Vermont. And they're in Burlington. And everybody points to Burlington as this great example. This is a town that's filled with co-ops. The whole waterfront is cooperative right now. Nobody owns that prime real estate, so everybody can use it. They have, you know, these wood chip factories that generate a lot of their electricity. You know,
it's funny, with both you and Bill McKibben, it always comes back to Vermont as the utopia.
Well,
what is that about?
Well, you know, there's probably a reason why Bill's living there. He really likes the place. And, you know, obviously there are great local boosters. Right. But go up to Burlington and you notice a heck of a lot of happy people. I mean, they just really enjoy where they are. And this is sort of the vision mm-hmm. that Matsusani and some other people I see, Cable Oiwa, who founded the slow move food movement in Japan, who's a wonderful philosopher at the University of Yokohama, they see that this is an inevitable transition that they are entering right now, and it's just going to be better all around for everybody. We're pretty flexible creatures. That's why we've survived this far. And at a certain point, you know, stuff is instant gratification. It's great when you buy something new, and 5 days later, it's not so new or novel anymore. But going outside, having picnics, that stuff never gets old if you're in the habit of doing it.
Yeah. Alan, we're almost at the point where we want to open up for the audience, and there were still a lot of other questions I wanted to ask, particularly about the way in which you deal with biodiversity and endangered species, which is something that is very, very dear to my heart. We're not going to have time for that, but let me ask you, sort of by way of conclusion, so what would you ideally like for the impact of this book to be? I mean, you mentioned earlier, and I think you were alluding to Paul Ehrlich, you said, well, possibly the U.S. is one of the most overpopulated countries in the world. Mm-hmm. So what would you like to see sort of, if you had your druthers, what would you like your book change in the U.S.? And is there something that you maybe also ideally envision your book might do for the world?
Well, you know, I don't pull any punches in this book. I describe what is going on the planet in fairly sobering terms. You know, we really have some problems right now with changing climate. It's going to be eating away at our coastlines. Our seas are going to be rising. This is now a fact that is accepted by 98.5% of all scientists on the planet. And anybody with a measuring stick, you know, can tell that oceans are now rising. So we're going to have to make some adjustments. And some of these things are going to be downright scary. You know, if seas rise, the most important foodstuff in terms of in the number of people who consume it is rice. How much of that stuff is grown at sea level? I mean, what are we going to do? Put coastal dikes along entire continents? This is very expensive. You know, when I was in Manila for this book, the Dutch ambassador, you know, told, you know, Manila, well, you know, you're sinking, the seas are rising, you have to put dikes here. They can't afford that in the Philippines like they can in Amsterdam. And, you know, we're going to have some really important adjustments to make during this century. One of the ways that, again, it's technology we already have, one of the ways that we can lessen the level of pain is simply by circling the wagons a little bit. You know, just like as a Talmudic scholar who's also an ecologist in Tel Aviv told me, he says, you know, in the beginning, be fruitful and multiply. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they were all polygamists, and they were having a lot of babies. But then one of Jacob's 13 children, Joseph, realized that, you know, there are times of scarcity on this planet. And he has just one wife, and they hold themselves to just two children, and he counsels the Israelites and the Pharaoh of Egypt that in order to save ourselves, we have to conserve now. And it worked, and it did save himself. And I think this might be one of the times that we have to be thinking about this. What I'm hoping that my book shows is that this is something that we can do now, and we're going to get lots of benefits. I mean, the economists always worry, oh my God, you know, all those old people and all these, just these young people, who's going to, you know, who's going to pay into the coffers? Well, frankly, a lot of those economists, these pro-growth economists, what they're really saying is that they love big populations because that makes labor cheaper. You get a lot of poor people competing with each other for the lowest wage because they want a job. And all these educated women, we educate the women of the world, you know, the labor force of the world, a much more educated, sharper one, the transition over a series of decades will not be that hard. We're not going to do it overnight, nor mm-hmm. should we. But we can do this, and this is I hope this book really is showing people that there is hope that we can manage this. Because if we don't, nature's going to probably do it to us. I don't think we're going to get to 11 billion. And, you know, you watch Survival of the Fittest on the National Geographic Channel, it's kind of entertaining. But when it's happening to your own species, it's not so pretty.
Thank you, Alan. I have a lot more questions. but I'm sure a lot of you have questions about these fascinating issues that come up through this book. So we're going to turn it over to you, and we're going to have microphones going around.
Hi. I have a question in regards to healthcare and elimination of diseases. So there's Bill Gates and trying to eliminate diseases in Africa and eliminate those kinds of things. And then there's, you know, the advancements in healthcare and trying to prolong life in America. How does that fit in to your scenario of growth, and how do you look at that?
Thanks for asking that question. You know, there's only two ways a population grow on this planet. You know, more people are born than die, and people live longer, so they hang around more. And it's happened for two reasons on this planet. One is medical technology, and the other is enhanced food technology. In the 20th century, we learned how to produce much more food than nature ever could. The medical technology issue, until we had a vaccination for smallpox and then other vaccinations and pasteurization of milk and all that stuff, our population barely grew. It was just creeping up slightly, because the women would have seven or eight kids, maybe two, just slightly more than two of them would survive on the average. I mean, imagine the pain of our ancestors. Most babies didn't make it through their first year, and about half of those were dead by their fifth birthday. So we've turned all that around, and back then, life expectancy was 40. Being over 40 myself, nobody over 40 has anything against medical technology, and I certainly don't argue that we shouldn't do it. But I'm glad that you asked about you mentioned Bill and Melinda Gates, because for a while now, they have been trying very hard, putting a lot of money into HIV and malaria programs, trying to eradicate them. And every one of us who's ever seen the ravages of those two diseases, we pray that they are going to succeed. But in recent years, they've really come to understand that by solving one thing, you exacerbate another on a planet that is stretched and stressed right now. So they are now some of the biggest funders of family planning in the world, because they realize that you're going to be responsible for all these children. The Green Revolution is oftentimes touted as having refuted Paul Ehrlich and refuted Malthus, but in fact, it created all these kids. Because people who didn't die of the famine then lived to beget more children, who begat more children. Now, India is about to surpass China as the most populous nation on the planet, and Pakistan's one of the fastest growing. And we were talking about it earlier. It's one of the scariest places I went to in this book. 185 million people in a country the size of Texas, and Texas only got 26 million. And by the middle of the...
There's a point.
Yeah. By the middle of this century, if the growth doesn't abate, Pakistan will have more people than are in the United States right now, many more. We're at 315 million, it's going to be 395 million, and it'll still be the size of Texas. So whatever we do to prolong people's lives, it's just a no-brainer here. Let's give those people an opportunity for a good quality life by not making the planet so crowded that we can't each have a reasonable share of the beautiful bounty on this planet. Next.
I haven't read your book, but I have a feeling that we're dancing around the edges, because it seems if we don't deal with consumption in this country, in China, in all of the developed countries, that we can limit the population, but we're going to have the same problems with the planet.
Well, on the one hand, you're kind of right. Consumption is a huge issue. And, you know, I flippantly said before, there's no condom for it. But seriously, I don't know how we would do it. You know, there's a couple of scientists from Oregon State who I cite in here who did a study. And they picked a typical woman in Oregon who was trying to do absolutely everything to minimize her ecological footprint, driving a Prius, not driving it, you know, driving it only a limited number of miles, compact fluorescent everything, you know, had her own garden and all this. And then they calculated the carbon legacy of every child she would have. And it goes into thousands and thousands of tons of carbon for each child and then the progeny of that child. I mean, there's, you know, it's really, really significant to understand that right now we're at such a mass of humanity on this planet and we're all demanding energy, either the really concentrated form or even just the firewood form, like I saw in Niger, but that's all having an impact. So the one thing that I know that we can do is cut down on the number of consumers while we're trying to solve consumption or come up with better ways of recycling everything that we consume so we can use it over and over again, which is what nature does. Nature's a very good industrial model, and there's a lot of great plans out there to how we can mimic it better. Paul Hawkins written books about that. Janine Benyus wrote a fabulous one called Biomimicry. I can't write every book. I wrote this one about this particular subject because it's not the solution. There's no silver bullet here, but it's one of the things that could have an impact probably the fastest.
Quite a few other people.
Yeah, there's someone over here. There's someone everywhere. Let's go ahead.
Catholicism is fairly rare among the major religions in that there is one figurehead who sort of commands all the people who are believing. And what effect do you think it would have if someone like Pope Francis, for example, were to say, you know what, birth control, it's okay?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen because, and this is nothing against Francis, because he certainly is a breath of fresh air in many ways, but I had to learn the history of why the Catholic Church is opposed to birth control. And I go to the Vatican. I have some rather interesting conversations there with some cardinals in the Vatican. It turns out that, I'll try to make this really quick, in the middle of the 19th century, the Papal States was a middle-sized European country. But there was a social uprising, and they lost all their territory except for this 110 acres that they have today. So, you know, if you only got 110 acres, you're not exactly a powerhouse anymore. So they had to come up with something really quick. This is Pope Pius IX, of how to still be considered powerful. Papal infallibility. That's when it was invented. So ever since then, papal infallibility has, you know, when you're talking with the word of God, you know, that's what's coming through your mouth, suddenly people got to pay attention, right? So then contraception starts happening, you know, with Margaret Sanger and all these people in the beginning of the 20th century. And they're still, now that they're so small physically, they're really into be fruitful and multiply for their flock. They want to proselytize and have as many Catholics as possible, and birth control is counterproductive for them. So they get really against birth control. But then come the 60s, the pill is out there. I have a great chapter in here about how Catholic Costa Rica came down below replacement rate, largely because the evangelical churches realized, ooh, this is a vulnerable spot. And they started running these radio ads saying, what, your God doesn't like you? And he says you're a sinner because you want to be responsible, have the number of kids you can take care of? Our God loves you. Our church welcomes you. And in contraception and evangelical Protestantism went hand in hand. And, you know, I interviewed the head of Planned Parenthood and the State Demographic Institute in Costa Rica. She's a Jehovah's Witness. And she said, you know, we intend to be the majority around here fairly soon. Catholicism is losing its clout. In two points, once during Vatican II and once a white paper in 1994 that John Paul II requested the Pontifical Academy of Sciences to prepare because he really thought that population was leveling off. So, you know, he asked all, it was bishops, lay Catholics, scientists. In both occasions, the recommendation was, in the second time, the Pontifical Academy, this was on a scientific basis, they said it's unconscionable to recommend that people have any more than 2.3 kids per family because it would just be unsustainable to the point of absurdity. Nevertheless, they're locked into it. If they say, and in the minority opinion to the Vatican II Council vote on, that was studying this problem, and they voted 69-10 to legalize abortion, not abortion, to legalize contraception under canon law, the minority opinion was written by this Polish bishop named Karol Wojtyla, who later, of course, became John Paul II. And he pointed out, if we allow this to happen, we will in effect be saying that for a century we have been wrong and the Protestants were right. And of course, this would deny papal infallibility and then no power. The house of cards would collapse. As it happens, one of the countries that has the best family planning record on the planet happens to be Catholic Italy. They had no program whatsoever, except they've done a great job of educating females. One of the highest percentages, if not the highest percentage, of females with graduate degrees on this planet, and they have one or two kids, max. And they're way below replacement rate, and they still consider themselves Catholic, and they just don't pay attention to... the population of Vatican City is about 1,000, and most of them are male. Nearly all of them are male, and most of them are gray-haired male. And a young woman looks at these guys and say, come on, you know. I mean, look, I don't want to insult any Catholics here. One of my great mentors in life was a Catholic priest, and he's actually in the book, because it turned out something very, very pertinent that referred to him was very helpful for me to include in this book. So every religion, you know, wants to be powerful. And this is, they've painted themselves into a corner on this one.
We have time for one more question.
I'm sorry, but it's still on consumption. Maybe that's your next book. and it was, what do you think, it's sort of an answer to your question, how do you get people to change and so on and so on. What do you think of the fact that millennials and many more are in America and all over Europe and now spreading all over the world, a return to a sharing economy? People don't need to buy a car, don't need to buy their own bike, etc.
I think it's a great adjustment. I think that this is one of the steps that we are starting to make where it makes sense for us to, you know, to do things that would be extremely expensive if we tried to do them separately. We've got this tool called the internet right now. We share information like crazy that we never used to do before. Information, I mean, libraries, like this wonderful one right here. You know, in most countries in the world, libraries, you needed a special pass to go in there. Information was kind of secret, and only the power structure had access to it. Now everybody's got access to it. And a lot of this stuff is starting to make sense. And I don't meet many young people who want to live excessive lives by having way too many children when they just would like a nice, comfortable lifestyle for themselves. And they're learning if it's too expensive to own a car, well, a bunch of us can own that car and we can share it. So, you know, we're really flexible. At one point, I mentioned in this book, I was in Guangzhou University in China talking to 400 kids, and they were really smart and they were really bright and really excited because they weren't stuck in the Cultural Revolution. They had access to education, and there were great job opportunities. You know, the sky was the limit for them, but literally, because outside the sky was so murky, you could stare at the sun all day long. And they were very, very interested in environmental control because they were concerned about their future. And at one point, it occurred to me, and I asked my translator, the young woman, I said, is everybody an only child here? And she said, yeah, of course we are. And I said to them, I said, you know, one of the things that people are concerned about is that only children are going to miss the family experience, the, you know, having siblings. I mean, and that this is going to be psychologically really kind of difficult for a lot of people. But you guys seem pretty mentally well established. You know, you don't seem particularly crazy. And I said, do you miss having siblings? And they said, yeah, you know, our parents had them. It would be really nice, but we've sort of reinvented the family. Our cousins are our siblings, and our best friends are our siblings. And when they said that to me, I realized, here's another example of how flexible humanity is. You know, that we find a way to make do and to accommodate and to do well. And these kids are doing really well. Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody should be an only child. One-child policy isn't going to fly. But knowing that you can at least have two is acceptable. And a lot of people end up only having one anyhow. Or if you want more, you know, there's one resource on this planet that isn't a diminishing scarcity yet, and that's children who need a home. You know, you can adopt more children and have as large a family as you want. And I was talking, I was on television today, and the host of the program who was interviewing me told me that she was from a Mormon family. You know, traditionally they have big families. And I asked her if she had children yet. She says, no, I don't intend to have any. I'm going to do what my parents did. They wanted a big family, but they wanted to be responsible. And they've adopted most of my siblings. And, you know, this is a way that we can have our world and continue to have what we want. We have to make a few adjustments, and then they turn out to be actually rather beautiful. You know, even dealing with that issue in China about the discrimination and gender discrimination against young Chinese girls, well, we did find a way to deal with that, so suddenly we weren't looking at infanticide or looking at abortion. We looked at adoption, and now here in America and Europe and in Australia, there's a beautiful sprinkling of these young Chinese girls who've been adopted by people who couldn't have children, and all they've done is enrich our culture and enrich our gene pool and enrich our world. So I'm not suggesting that anything is going to be easy in the 21st century. We're in for a wild ride. But I am suggesting that there are a lot of things that we can do, and I came out of this book more hopeful than I went into it.
Thank you, Alan.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.